And welcome to this week's episode of Until Green Card Doers Part, a weekly show where we address the issues that immigration-based marriages made a few feet short of heaven create for American citizens and their families. I'm your host, John Sampson, CEO of CSI Consulting. Now, for the last 2 weeks, I've had a guest on the show. Emily has appeared on the show to tell us her story. And this week, she comes back and she and I discuss possible solutions to the I-864 Affidavit of Support being used by immigrants who scam U.S. citizens into marrying them not only for the green card, but also suing them over the Affidavit of Support, thereby causing the U.S. citizen to have to pay for the privilege of being defrauded. Without any further ado, here's Emily. Welcome back, Emily.
Oh, I'm so happy to be back and share some more of my pain. Thank you.
we'll try to make this as painless as possible. So what we're going to do today, and I'm of the opinion that this may very well turn into a regular thing with us both doing this show as opposed to just me. But let's see how that goes a little further down the line. But
for today,
I like the idea too. For today's purposes, what I'd like to discuss with you is we're going to look at the 864 Affidavit of Support in connection with sham marriages where the alien comes in, marries a U.S. citizen either here in the States or abroad, and then the 864 comes into play, and then the citizen finds out that they've been scammed, and then they, to add insult to injury, get to pay for the privilege of being scammed because the alien then turns around and sues them on the 864 Affidavit of Support, which, from what you've told me, apparently is a major concern of yours because of some of the things your now ex-husband is saying. So I'll leave it to you to take up where we left off.
Yeah, first can I just say, I thought about doing a blog and calling it Until I-864 do us part, but I think your Until Green Card do us part is a little more catchy.
Okay.
So, anyways, the I-864 is like my worst nightmare. It's the most draconian prenuptial agreement anyone could have dreamed up. And I don't know where you want me to start, but I definitely go into like the fact that the U.S. citizen has absolutely no control whatsoever.
That's correct.
Over this agreement and how it's enforced. And there's like, I don't remember, there's like five and variations of ways that it can be not nullified, well, nullified or not enforced. And not a single one of those is under the control of the sponsor.
All right, so let's go through those. The I-864 terminates on one of several events. The first event is the death of either the U.S. citizen or the alien. Okay.
And now, in most cases, the U.S. citizen has no control over that, we hope.
Well, this is true. The second event is the alien naturalizes, becomes a United States citizen through naturalization. The third event,
I think that's very unlikely because if you've got a cow that you can milk, why would you do that? You're able to get $20,000 or $30,000 and work and get money on under the table, I think you have some situations, but in mine, like there's no reason he would become a U.S. citizen because then he wouldn't get any money out of me.
Well, we'll get into that because there is a couple of thoughts I have going down that line. The third event is if the alien works 40 qualifying quarters for the purposes of Social Security. Now, oftentimes American citizens misinterpret that to mean, oh, it's only 10 years. And you and I have had this conversation where it doesn't mean 10 years because if your husband either doesn't work on the books or doesn't work, period. Well, let's say
even legitimate work, 1099 contract work.
Right.
He starts his own business but doesn't pay Social Security wages.
Right.
Like, I had no idea that there were all these caveats and he could be working. Mm-hmm. And even, reporting or not reporting, either way, to the IRS still, it doesn't count. Well, and it could go on indefinitely.
It doesn't terminate the agreement, but what it does do, and this is something that U.S. citizens are not told either, is that there's what's called a set-off. And what that means is that if the alien works, let me use a case that's going on in Maryland where the U.S. citizen married a woman who's now a doctor, and she lives in Pennsylvania. They never lived. Mm-hmm. They never lived together as husband and wife, by the way.
Wow.
So there's all sorts of things going on with that. But as far as the 864 is concerned, let's assume she tried to sue my client. And he, during the course of the lawsuit through discovery, you get demands for documents, which is provide us with your bank accounts, provide us with your tax records, provide us with your employment documentation from your employer. And if the doctor is making more than 125% of the federal income poverty guidelines, then although the agreement is still, the contract is still in effect, the amount of money she makes is subtracted from the 125% of the federal income poverty guidelines. So if she's making more, she gets nothing. So,
oh, right. So that's for the income calculation, like how much you actually owe, but not towards the...
For the longevity. Not for the longevity of the agreement of the contract. So those are three. And then the fourth is if the alien permanently leaves the United States, either voluntarily or under an order of removal. There is some speculation on that, that all that requires is the actual issuance of a notice to appear in removal proceedings. Because what the government is saying, that the purpose or the validity of the visa no longer exists, so therefore, by extension, neither does the 864. Mm. So, and then the fifth...
The voluntary, man, I still don't see them voluntarily doing this.
Well, voluntarily is, you know, let me give you an example. A lot of people sometimes get a green card, not because they intend to live in the United States now, but they're hedging their bets, they're getting permanent residence, they go back to their home country and they live there. And then if things deteriorate to the point where it's untenable, they come back to the United States. The problem is that there's a provision in the law that says, if you've lived outside the United States for more than a year as a permanent resident, you have constructively abandoned your permanent residence, mm-hmm. and the government can take your green card, put you in front of an immigration judge to confirm this, et cetera. But the fifth way that the agreement terminates is if the alien qualifies for another immigrant visa that does not require the 864 to have been entered into. Yep. So here are a couple of hypothetical situations. Let's say your husband is placed in removal proceedings. The moment the NTA is filed, you're off the hook. Now, what happens is he can apply for relief from removal. There's several types of relief. There's voluntary departure. There's adjustment of status under some other section of law. There is withholding of removal. There is asylum if he's been here less than a year. There is convention against torture. And then there is the one that most people apply for, which is cancellation of removal, which is, yes, you can remove me, but if you do, then it would result in extreme and exceptional hardship to me and or U.S. citizen spouse or my children. So those are some of the ways to terminate the agreement. But like you and I have been saying, the American citizens who are signing off on this generally are not schooled in this. Even if they hire an immigration attorney And this is this is the bone of contention you have with the attorney that you hired. And by the way, I applaud you for going after that attorney, because I think they need to be held to account. But then again, as
thank you. And after our last podcast, I'm going to write to the investigator and tell them, oh, and there's this other thing they didn't tell me, that I didn't have to sign the I-864 and file for the adjustment of status right away. I could have done the work authorization on its own. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate participating in this very much.
You're welcome.
I'm going to give them a little more information.
So you and I have kicked around this idea, and I think it's a pretty good one, that we link the 864 affidavits of support to conditional permanent residence, in that the 864 does not take full force and effect until and unless the conditions of permanent residence are removed based on a valid marriage.
Yes, 100%.
You know,
like, this is the trial period. This 2 years is a trial period. So this is what blows my mind, is that you could get through the 2 years, be legitimate, and I have heard this from some folks, it's actually an American and a Canadian, get through the two years, through the interview process, and then you're called for a final interview. And this one couple I know, they actually were initially rejected because they hadn't intermingled their finances. And she's like, man, my finances are my finances. I'm an independent woman. And they had to intermingle them and appealed, and then were able to get it. So, you know, the U.S. government could be extremely critical of what is otherwise a valid marriage if they have any question marks about it.
Right.
And that's their opportunity to say, we think this is fraudulent. Either we reject or we subject you to additional information, interviews, et cetera. Now, in those 2 years, if the U.S. citizen says, I believe this is fraud, mm-hmm. nothing happens. The immigrant has the opportunity to do all of these waivers, one of which, you know, at some point we'll get into, is VAWA. So, you know, and then the U.S. citizen even saying, I know I've been defrauded. They even told me verbally that they were defrauding me, but I can't prove it because nobody walks around a voice recording all the time.
Right.
But I don't have any opportunity in those 2 years to withdraw my I-864, my support for the marriage, anything else. So that's what, it's this weird limbo period where you're supposed to have come in under marriage, you get divorced, you have a breakup, you realize, like, well, what if you just realize you don't like this person? You know, you haven't lived together in the U.S.
Right.
You know, should you go, I simply made a mistake. This was valid. It was not fraudulent. But 2 months in, you're like, oopsie. You know, we don't really get along here. I mean, people have gotten married before and regretted it, have they not? And then the U.S. citizen, you know, can say, I want to get a divorce. There's no man or woman on this planet who would knowledgeably enter into agreement that says, I'm going to marry someone, U.S. citizen to U.S. citizen, I'm going to marry a man or woman. And no matter what they do to me, if we just don't get along, if they cheat on me, if they beat me, if they defraud me, if they steal money, if they abandon me, no matter what they do, if I want a divorce or I simply break up with them because of the treatment, I will have to pay them maybe $20,000, maybe $30,000 a year. And depending on whether or not those Social Security quarters start to, you know, that clock starts ticking, I could potentially have to pay that forever. There has to be some kind of out. And I think that trial period is where there should be the out. And there can be provisions that the immigrant can still stay without the marriage, right? Mm. Like, if they want to stand on their own, if they've got the asylum, extreme hardship, like, have other routes, but...
Right.
If the government decides then, okay, we're going to let you stay, it still shouldn't be up to the U.S. citizen to pay this indefinitely.
Correct.
To a person that's mistreated them, let alone defrauded them. Like you said, it's paying for the right.
So paying for the privilege of being defrauded, yes. Thank you very much.
And
it's a gift that keeps on giving. I mean, it's...
Yeah, thank you, yes.
and the contract, you know, I've talked to attorneys... But because of what I do, I talk to attorneys quite a bit. And every single one of them that I've spoken to says the same thing. Because when we all went through law school, myself included, and we sat through a year of contracts, two semesters worth, you know, an unconscionable contract is where you have absolutely no remedies afforded to one of the parties of the contract should the contract be broken. Okay. So, and what you got to look at is marriage is a contract. And the contract is that we intend, when I married my wife, you know, we took our vows and we proclaimed to the world that we would be husband and wife through sickness and in health, you know, richer or poorer, good times and bad, until death do us part. Okay. Green card notwithstanding. And if it ended in divorce, you've voided out the contract, you've breached it. So to have a requirement that you have to continue to pay for an immigrant spouse who on their end of it, their actions defrauded you, yes, the U.S. citizen, hoodwinked you,
yes,
gaslighted you, however you want to put it. And then at the end of the day, all of the above, and then at the end of the day, you know, they say, ha ha, got you, got what I wanted. And oh, by the way, in your case, physically abused you as well. And then turns around and says, I want you to support me to the tune of 125% of federal income poverty guidelines, and in your case, for three, because not only are you supporting him, you're supporting the two kids he brought with him. So with that in mind, there has to be some sort of a remedy. And the unfortunate part about this is that the litigation cases that have gone through federal district courts throughout the country, the decisions are not favorable to the United States citizen, because the politics of immigration has interfered. The open borders, coming to this country as an immigrant is a right, nor do we want to do anything that could potentially result in the immigrant from being removed, which is the now politically correct term that has supposedly replaced deportation. Deportation has been given a negative connotation to it. So when 1996, when they modified the immigration law, they changed the terminology somewhat. It's a notice to appear in removal proceedings as opposed to a notice to appear in deportation proceedings. So, yeah.
So that's it, because we talk about, I still use the term, deportable offenses, because when you say, like, okay, it's a right, not a privilege, but I still think, I've mentioned this before, I'm super liberal, always been pro-immigrant in my life. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say that's changing. I would say that I do care about the quality of the person we're letting in. And someone who is willing to commit fraud, I'm not down with that. And then all these other deportable offenses, I actually don't think the list is enough, because within the first year he got a DUI. So do you want somebody that's committing? I've never even come close. I know a few people, but not many, that have had DUI. So instantly comes in, gets a DUI. There's other stuff like violence, including spousal abuse. But as I found, it's very difficult to prove what happened one night. It's very difficult to prove that the miscarriage I suffered a week later was directly due to that, basically impossible. And you have to have a DA that's willing to charge them and take it to trial, and then a jury to actually convict. So even if, again, I do everything on my part, and I did, because I believe if somebody punches me in the face, they should get arrested for it.
Right. that's a reasonable.
And I told him that. I'm like, that's a deal breaker. That's the deal breaker, and I think he knew that, and that's why he did that, because he couldn't sue me if we were still together.
Right.
So, you know, and there's a bunch of other stuff, too. Violating a restraining order, they actually dropped that, too. Tax evasion. that's a federal offense. But how on earth, you know, I know his MO is to work under the table and avoid taxes. He's from Tanzania, never filed taxes once when he was there. There's no way that I could prove that. Absolutely none. And I know he'll be doing it. And so that's not in my control. That's in the IRS's control.
Well, it's also
in
And
then
it's also,
my final and favorite.
Yeah, go ahead. No, go ahead. You do it first.
Okay. My final and my favorite is that perjury is a deportable offense. Mm-hmm. And there's so many things in my trial where I'm like, I can't believe you never said you cheated on me. I would have the text. You don't bring every exhibit to the trial. You bring those to prove your point. There's so many things that I'm like, okay, I can prove that's a lie. I can prove that's a lie. I can prove that's a lie. And, you know, in talking with you and my attorney, I'm like, you know, is there no actual consequence for perjury? Like, how would you actually go about this? Well, it turns out I would need that same, very, very same DA who dropped all the charges with the restraining order violations and the assault. I would have to get him to file charges for perjury. So do you think he's going to do that?
The answer to that question is a resounding no, and here's the reason. You're talking yeah. about the very same district attorney who applauded the people in your town who
yes.
demonstrated and interfered with Immigration and Customs Enforcement in enforcing the immigration laws of this country, in which the district attorney there said, I am very proud of my constituents. So the answer to that question is that you live in, unfortunately, for immigration purposes, you live in a sanctuary jurisdiction where the district attorney yeah. is not going to do anything that could potentially result in a non-U.S. citizen from being removed from or deported from the United States. What I find increasingly amusing is that the people who take offense to the term deportation have a tendency of using it a whole lot when they speak about this subject. Now,
yeah.
We can do a whole episode on a show about sanctuary jurisdictions and alternative plea agreements and deals that insulate non-U.S. citizens from immigration consequences for their criminal acts. And maybe we will do that in a...
I think we should, because it was a technique at everything. The restraining order contestation hearing
yeah.
brought up the I-864. Every point along the way, I-864 and potential for being deported. And so they just kept dropping. I'm like, how is this possible?
Well, it's because...
You know, I'm educated, you know, professional, active in the community, articulate, I think credible, and you're actually not standing up for me. It blew my mind. But I got to tell you too, John, like, before all this happened, I would have been one of those demonstrators. I would have been pro-immigrant and yeah. anti-ICE, 100%. And I had friends that were like, oh, I hate what Trump's doing, it's terrible, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, wait a minute, did you know one of those guys actually was convicted for domestic violence? You know, are you telling me that when they come for my husband, you'll be out there trying to stop them from taking him too? And they're like, oh. You know, I'm like, I looked into these two guys actually had criminal convictions
right.
that were deportable.
Correct. And we had a case up here in Denver.
But I didn't know. Yeah, I didn't know how all of this worked. Now, unfortunately, I'm on the other side, and I do. And I was like, not jumping in the Facebook parade about how we all needed to rally and stop ICE from taking these two guys away.
Right. So getting back to the 864, I think if we can come up
yes.
with some sort of a resolution, and for anybody out there who's listening and has some ideas about this, here we go with the plug. You can get on the Facebook page entitled Until Green Card Do Us Part and leave a comment or message me through Facebook Messenger, and I will get back to you. But I'm willing to hear any ideas or any thoughts or any concepts that anybody has that would allow us to soften the blow, if you will, or give the U.S. citizen some plausible remedies when they find themselves the victim of a fraud. And then not only are they being, as you know, we've said this a few times, not only are they being defrauded, they're paying for the privilege of being defrauded, because now they have to support the person that defrauded them, that defrauded them into bringing them into the country. Now they get to pay for the, you know, potentially for life. I mean, if none of the events occur that terminates the agreement, then it's conceivable that a U.S. citizen could be on the hook, you know, at the whim of the non-U.S. citizen for the rest of their lives. So there has to be some sort of a remedy that's available to U.S. citizens that says, you know, we don't want to be defrauded and then pay for the privilege for being defrauded. But on the flip side, the other side of the argument is, if you take away the 864, then the law says that that immigrant is presumed to be a likely to become a public charge, which is a grounds by which we can remove them. So there has to be a balance in order for this to be sold to everybody. I mean, if we take the hard line, the Trump line, if you will, and say, you know, I don't care, you know, pull the 864, and if the person gets removed, so be it. I don't see where the other side's going to come to the bargaining table and see this as being a reasonable solution. So the purpose is to come up with an idea that the 864 can be terminated, withdrawn during the 2-year period of the marriage. And we're going to get into that in a moment. But during the 2-year period of the marriage, the trial period is the conditional permanent resident period. If we can pull it back during that period of time and yet fashion some sort of remedy so that the immigrant can remain in the United States, unless you can show fraud, in which case then, as far as I'm concerned, you know, all bets are off.
All bets are off.
But I mean, if it's through no fault of the U.S. citizen, and it's no fault of the non-citizen, let's just say the marriage doesn't work out. And the marriage ends in divorce, but the U.S. citizen says, I want to withdraw the 864. Then I think what could happen is a waiver could be issued or established that says you don't need the 864 if this is a bona fide marriage and it just didn't end, or it just didn't work. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now let's talk about the K-1 fiancé visa, how that all works into this. What you and I were talking about made me stop and think. It's a 90-day visa. Okay.
Yes.
I'm thinking if we did a regulatory or technical tweak of the law involving K-1 visas, that instead of it being you have 90 days in which to get married, you say they come for 90 days, and the first 60 days you can't get married.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We're not gonna recognize the marriage if you get married within the first 60 days. Then you have 30 days in which to actually get married. Now, the first 60 gives you an opportunity for the fiancé to meet your family, meet your friends, get acclimated to the United States, plan the wedding, etc. And then you get married between day 60 and day 90, and then you submit the paperwork. And if it doesn't work out within the first 60 days, and this is where it comes back to the seminal question, coming here as an immigrant, is it a right or a privilege? If it doesn't work out, if it doesn't work out in the first 60 days, the person goes home. They just go home. They have no right to be here.
They're based on the potential to be married, and you're not going to get married. And that's that.
And then what happens in cases like that, unfortunately, is a case up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where a U.S. citizen brought in a Filipina in a 90-day fiancé mode. We should talk about that program also. The TV program, 90 Day Fiancé.
Yeah.
But so he brings her in.
Piece of work.
He brings her in. And within a week, he realizes, wait a minute, hold it. There's something wrong here. Methinks she's coming here to get a green card. So he tells her, this isn't working. And it deteriorates for another couple of weeks. And finally, he says, I'm going to buy you and your son a ticket, tickets to go back to the Philippines. Okay? Not going to marry you. Not going to marry you. So here's where the potential pitfall for this is. She then turns around and alleges that he raped her. And the Milwaukee Police Department has a anti-human trafficking task force in which Homeland Security Investigations is an active part. So the guy has now been charged with human trafficking twice, you know, two counts of human trafficking, two counts of rape, and two counts of domestic violence assault. And he's looking at life in prison without parole. Okay.
Oh, my God.
So, I mean, and this illustrates the point I'm getting here one way or the other, and I really don't care what happens to the U.S. citizen. It's they are what I call immigration sociopaths. They have no soul. So,
yes. You know, once my ex said, I will do anything in my power for my kids, I didn't realize that also meant defrauding and traumatizing me. And now I see, and you can kind of, you know, there's a little, you can understand when somebody has $7 in their bank account, the equivalent, right? No real education. No, you know, the situation on the ground, we've said before, he's in Tanzania. He's less than positive and very corrupt.
Yeah.
And you say, I will do anything. Would you sacrifice this one other human for the sake of you, your kids, your family, where you can send money back? You know, people do desperate things. And so that's part of where I think there need to be so many more protections for the U.S. citizen, where you're in love. You see them in their environment. It's all great. I mean, we had conversations about, what if you come and you just don't like it? And, you know, and he's like, well, that would suck. But, you know, he actually said once he was taking all the risk.
But he never did.
Taking all the risk. What do you mean? But I promised. I said, I'll buy you a ticket back. Like, you make shillingi, you make shillings. I make dollars. This is the reality, is I've taken the financial risk. If you don't like it here, then I have to buy you tickets back. So guess what happens when I offer to buy the tickets back?
He didn't want to go.
Oh, no. Oh, no, I want to stay. I want to get a green card, and I want you to pay. And he literally said, I want to stay, and you have to pay. That was the refrain. I want to stay, and you have to pay. And I'm like, wait a minute, what? I wanted love and a family and a partner.
And what you got? And what you got was a gate crasher. Sorry, but I mean that's
so
what.
I'm curious, like what? So what happens to the immigrant in that case because they're in on a fiancé visa?
What's supposed to happen and what does happen are two entirely different things. What's supposed to happen is it's a non-immigrant visa, okay. You cannot adjust status or change status to any other visa except under the Violence Against Women Act provisions of the Immigration and Nationality Act.
No way. Even on a fiancé visa.
On a fiancé visa, not only that, but you can't say, well, I was going to marry Emily, but that didn't work out, so I'm going to marry Jane instead. No, can't do that. That visa was specifically issued for you to marry Emily. So theoretically, what's supposed to happen is you're now out of status. A notice to appear in removal proceedings should be issued. And then the whole removal process starts. And for anybody who's listening out there and thinks that what happens in real life is that ICE shows up at 6 a.m. in the morning, breaks down the door and drags you out of your bed, kicking and screaming, packs you up, throws you in a van, takes you to the airport and puts your happy little butt on an airplane and sends you out of the country. That is the furthest thing from the truth. Anybody who suggests that that's what happens is lying to you or is pathetically stupid and ignorant. Because what happens in removal proceedings is that you're issued a notice to appear in removal proceedings, which is the charging document, and it alleges that you're not a citizen of the United States, that you're a citizen of, in this case, Tanzania, that you entered the United States on or about such and such a date at such and such a place, and you are, depending on how you got in this case, admitted as a K-1 fiancé visa for a period of authorized stay not to exceed 90 days, for which there is no extension of stay, by the way. And All right, and you violated the terms and conditions of your admission. Therefore, you're removable and deportable under Section 237A, whatever the subsection is. Okay. So those are the allegations. Now, depending on the circumstances, you may be physically arrested by ICE, taken to the office, fingerprinted, photographed, biometrics taken, entered into Enforce, which is the database that's used by enforcement and removal operations and Homeland Security investigations and Customs and Border Protection. Okay. Now, depending on your circumstances, you may either be released on your own recognizance. You may be released under an alternative to detention, which would be you either phone in or you wear an ankle bracelet, or the field office director sets a bond, the minimum of which is $5,000. Now, it's paid either cash or surety. We don't take property. Surety, You have a certain amount of bonding companies that are authorized by the Treasury Department to write immigration bonds. And usually they charge the immigrant 10 to 15, maybe 20% of what the bond is as a bond fee. And then what they do for the balance is they collateralize it. Meaning if you have a friend who's posting your immigration bond for you, they're either going to have to put up their house, their car, whatever. And So minimum bond is $5,000. If you're going to pay the bond outright, it's $5,000. There's no, you don't pay 10% and get out on a $500 bond. You pay the full $5,000. And then you're released. If you are a convicted criminal alien, then at that point, the decision gets made either if you're an aggravated felony or an aggravated felon, as defined under the immigration law, then there's no bond for you. Okay. And if you're not a permanent resident, let's say your husband committed an aggravated felony against you. And an aggravated felony against you would be he assaulted you and he received a 1-year jail sentence, and even if they suspended it. Okay. And he was here as a non-immigrant, he would be on a fast plane back to Tanzania, because at that point you can do what's called an administrative removal. They don't have a right to have a hearing before a judge if they're an aggravated felon and they're not an immigrant. If they're an immigrant, they get held without bond and they go through the whole removal process in front of an immigration judge. And the immigration judge works for the Department of Justice. They don't work for the Department of Homeland Security. So let's assume the alien gets ordered removed. They don't like that. And let's assume they're out on bond or they're out on some other form of recognizance. And they get ordered removed and they file an appeal with the Board of Immigration Appeals within 30 days of that removal order. They get to stay in the United States during that entire period of the pending appeal. And if they're eligible to get work authorization, they get work authorization. And a BIA, and it goes to the Board of Immigration Appeals in Falls Church, Virginia. And it takes upwards of 3, 4, 5 years for the BIA to issue a decision.
Whoa.
So, if anybody thinks that this is like overnight, poof, but beam me up, Scotty, and, they go up to the Enterprise, and the next thing they know, they're back home in Tanzania. No, that doesn't work that way. So, in fact, I've often said that non-U.S. citizens in removal proceedings have greater due process rights than U.S. citizens charged with federal felonies. Because, well, here we go. If the Board of Immigration Appeals decides, no, you're getting deported, the non-U.S. citizen, the alien, if you will, can file a writ of habeas corpus with the Circuit Court of Appeals that has jurisdiction over them. If they are denied that, they could apply for a writ of certiorari to the Supreme Court of the United States. So here's what you got. You got a hearing before an immigration judge. You have an appeal before the Board of Immigration Appeals. You have a writ of habeas corpus before a Circuit Court of Appeals of the United States, and then you have the potential of taking it up to the Supreme Court of the United States. So you've got four bites of the due process apple. A U.S. citizen is charged with bank robbery. They have a trial in U.S. District Court. They have an appeal to the Circuit Court of Appeals, and then they go to the Supreme Court. They get three bites of the same due process apple that an alien gets four of.
Mm-hmm.
Wake up, America.
I feel like saying, because I think that people can get confused between undocumented and documented legals, and I also am appalled by the conditions at the border.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we're talking about is documented. We're talking about people that have come in legally and are working the system.
Well,
I just know people listening will be like, hey, wait a minute, but what about the kids in cages? They need due process, and they're not getting it.
Well,
right?
Here's the thing. Asylum and refugee status is controlled not only by the Immigration and Nationality Act, but it is also controlled by the United Nations High Commission on Refugees. Okay? So it gets a little bit more complicated. We could spend a whole week on asylum. We're talking about, there is a differentiation between unlawfully entering the United States, meaning you are not presenting yourself at a designated port of entry and present yourself for inspection to a Customs and Border Protection officer and applying for admission to the United States. Okay? That's the legal process. The illegal process, as we all know, is sneaking across the border, either Canada or Mexico. It happens both places. Or jumping ship as a crewman. Mm-hmm. Okay? We've had those too. Or swimming ashore. You have, Mariel Boatlift, for example, in the 80s, where they sailed from Mariel, Cuba, to Florida and came ashore that way. So if you're not presenting yourself at a designated port of entry, whether it be an airport, seaport, or land border port, and you're not applying for admission to the United States, then yes, if you get into the States, you have entered illegally. Now, with the kids in cages, one of two things are happening. They're either applying for asylum at the land border port, and they're not admissible, and the law requires that they be detained. There's no option on that one.
Mm-hmm.
Or they're coming across illegally and are being caught by the Border Patrol and immediately say, I'm seeking asylum, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Which calls into question the legitimacy of their asylum claim, because if you have a legitimate asylum claim, it would be much better to appear at a port of entry and apply for it that way than by sneaking across the border and if you just because you got caught.
And then state it once you're caught, yeah.
Right. So, we could sit here...
We could go on and on
like the Ever Ready battery, buddy.
Oh my God. Yes. But I just felt like making that point because if somebody's listening who's like, oh, these guys, everything, like all immigrants are looped into one.
No, they're not.
In one basket. And I want to make sure we're really, really clear to people. These are people that are abusing the very legitimate process.
Mm-hmm.
And traumatizing and destroying U.S. citizens' lives in the process. And the whole the whole system, the way that it's set up, especially the I-864, but other stuff we're going to get into, is just so skewed against, not even skewed against, like you said, it's unconscionable that this contract be enforced. I also forgot earlier when you're talking about law and contract enforceability, the other thing was about that it's, I forget what the term is, but it's like under duress. It's put in front of me.
Yeah,
it is. Otherwise, you will not be able to bring the love of your life over. Sign
correct.
It. Don't sign it. There is no other option, and there is no discussion about the implications. There's no review of the case law, which you start reading later and go, oh, my God, I'm so effed.
Yes.
It's you sign it or you don't. And so to me, that also feels like this is under duress.
It is. It is under duress.
Or you don't. Sign this prenup. You know what else? Oh, my God, I just realized this, John. I wanted to do a prenup, and we talked about protecting, you know, my home's my home, your home is your home in Tanzania, which, by the way, I put a bunch of money into and built out the second wing and blah, blah, blah. But that's my main thing. It's like, my home's my home. I don't want to become homeless. So I actually worked with an attorney here to draw up a prenup, but he said, you know, the thing is, I can't advise him. He needs to have his own attorney.
Right.
So that he's fully advised.
Mm-hmm.
And do you know what happened with this prenup, the I-864? It was sign it or don't. I had an attorney who didn't advise me.
Right.
Like, the way that this is, oh, man, I just... Yeah, I'm losing my words because I'm frustrated.
No. Let me see if I can clarify it for the listening audience. What we're seeing are a tale of two different... Well, one's a post-nup and the other one's a prenup. And let me tell you what the differentiation is. The 864 is more akin to a post-nuptial because you're going to sign the 864 after you get married.
Yep.
The prenup, obviously. So let's assume for sake of this argument, you did enter into a prenup, okay? And your husband signed off on it, and your husband was represented by his own counsel, and you signed this prenuptial agreement, and then you went out and got married, and then you signed the 864 affidavit of support and filed it with USCIS, okay? And in your prenuptial agreement, it says that he will not seek any spousal support from you should the marriage end in divorce or annulment. Okay. The moment you signed the 864, you invalidated the prenup because the prenup.
I know. I read that later and I was like, I guess it didn't matter. I can't beat myself up for not getting a prenup.
That blew
my mind too.
Well, you see.
You mean this whole thing, we could both have representation, that contract, and this other thing nullifies it, but also nobody tells me about that until he's trying to sue me for the support under the I-64.
Right.
Really?
And see, with...
Yeah, it's a rabbit hole, y'all. You get down further, it's people like, there's got to be some way out. I'm like, dude, there's no way out. This thing's crazy. This contract is crazy.
It is crazy. And it is under duress. Because like you said, if you don't sign it, they don't issue the visa. They're holding the visa over your head. Now, in all fairness to the 1996 Act revisions, which caused this, it's the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act. It's the immigrant responsibility portion of the law that we're talking about with the 864. It came about not because of marriage cases. It came about because we saw a spike in the number of immigrants coming from the former Soviet Union who were in their 60s or above, who came in on the coattails or shirttails of their children who had come into the country, gotten a green card one way or another, then ultimately naturalized and then petitioned for their mother, their fathers, their brothers, their sisters, their brother-in-laws, their sister-in-laws, their nieces, and their nephews, which is called chain migration. So the whole family comes over, and the elderly couple, mom and dad, immediately start drawing Social Security, having never paid into the system. Okay. So Congress is saying, wait a minute, hold it, time out. So in an effort to try and curb that, they came up with this 864 enforceable affidavit of support. originally, when it was initially enacted, the non-citizen had no participation in this at all. Zero. They never signed it. They never negotiated for it. They never were involved in this contract at all. It was initially a contract between the U.S. citizen and the U.S. government. Then,
right, which is also what I thought I was signing. Yes.
And then in early part of 2000s, an enterprising attorney in Fort Wayne, Indiana, representing Mrs. Stump, filed a lawsuit in U.S. District Court in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and the U.S. District Court judge granted Mrs. Stump, a citizen of Russia, mind you, third-party beneficiary status to that contract, which allowed her and the people to follow her the ability and the right to sue for its enforcement. So much so that there is now at least one law firm in Tacoma, Washington, that goes by the name of Immigrant Support Advocates, and they sue U.S. citizens on behalf of immigrants that they represent on the 864 Affidavit of Support, and they do it on a contingent fee basis. They take a third right off the top.
You're going to hear something really funny, John.
What?
I reached out to them when I was in a panic trying to figure out who are I-864 Affidavit of Support experts, and I found them so easily. Top of the page, Google it. And so I set up a consultation, and within minutes, they refunded my money and said they couldn't talk to me because of conflict of interest.
Uh-oh.
I actually reached out.
Hold it. When you started talking to them, did you mention your husband's name to them?
No.
Okay.
No, I didn't. I filled out a form and I told them briefly my situation, that my husband was from Tanzania.
Okay.
He had assaulted me. He's suing me for this, and I need legal counsel. And they turned and they said there was a conflict of interest. They never had his name. I never thought about that. Yep. So, but I, you know, obviously think it's because I'm a U.S. citizen and I'm not their bread and butter.
Right. And I don't, and here's the thing. They, not only are you not their bread and butter, but
I'm their cow to milk.
Exactly. So if they're not going to go ahead and take a case that will undo everything that's been done and have case law that would invalidate the 864 because A, it's unconscionable, and B, it's signed under duress. Okay. Because then it shuts down their business.
Yes.
So yeah, you're right. It is a conflict of interest
because
for them.
One thing that admires me about you, John, is if we get all of this fixed, it shuts down your business, but you're doing it because it's the right thing to do.
Well, as you and I have already discussed, I've had a very interesting November and December of last year with COVID, blood clots in the lungs, and a subsequent heart attack. So, long story short, as my wife keeps asking me, when are you going to really retire? And then in the next breath, she says, but then who's going to take it over from you, because there won't be anybody left to do the work you're doing? So on that note,
I couldn't find anyone but you.
Right. I'm
not, also, I'm not a Fox News reader, because again, we've mentioned multiple times my political proliferation.
Yeah, but you found
a Fox News article, and I was like, oh, thank Buddha.
Yeah. So
guy.
Yeah, there is somebody I am considering. In fact, we've been in consultation already, but the thing is, this person has about another 5 years to go before they're eligible to retire from USCIS. They are the head of fraud detection and national security in a particular city in the United States. And I know several of the FDNS people and the people that are on the ground, the grunts, want to do the right thing. The problem is that the politicians are prohibiting them from doing what should be the right thing to do. And I devoted 3 episodes of my podcast on all the corruption at the upper levels and echelons of USCIS, and that's where the problem lies. So what I'd like to do, because we are, believe it or not, we've been at this for just under 54 minutes.
I know. We can really get talking.
Yeah. So what I want to do is stop it here. And again, anybody who's listening, reach out to Until Green Card Doers Part on Facebook and messenger me through Facebook Messenger if you have any comments, any thoughts, any suggestions. We're open to it. I although I know a lot about this, I'm not the guy who's going to sit here and tell you there isn't anything I can learn. I can always learn. The day I stop learning is the day I'm no longer alive. So what I'd like to do is pick this up again next week and finish up on that and start tangentially going into the Violence Against Women Act, because it coincides with the 864, because what happens is, as you well know, the immigrant comes in, they get married, they get their two-year card, they immediately say, oh, she abused me or he abused me, and then they file a VAWA claim with USCIS. And that might be a way that if a VAWA claim is filed, and this is the last thing I want to talk about as far as getting rid of the 864. If a VAWA claim is filed, there is no provision. The law says that you do not need an 864 if you file an I-360 self-petition claiming you're the battered spouse of a U.S. citizen. What I want to do is extend that to the 751 so that if the alien says, I'm the victim of abuse and neglect and I'm filing for the waiver of the joint filing requirement under VAWA, then at that point, the 864 terminates.
Yep, and I'd be happy to drill down on that more next time.
All right, so take the week. Think about this, and you know, you and I are going to talk between now and then anyway, but I think that this episode has really gone, you know, longer than either one of us expected to go. Not that I'm complaining. I think this flowed really, really well. And again, we'll be back next week to pick up where we left off. And just keep on going. We have to fix this. We really do, because there are too many U.S. citizens that are getting adversely affected by all this. I mean, my phone rings off the hook almost every day. So with that in mind, Emily, again, thank you for calling in, or I called you actually, but thanks for appearing on the show. I'm looking forward to our future collaborations together. And to all of you out there, keep on listening, and Emily, we will see you next week.
Thanks, John.
Next week, we'll continue with Emily and what her suggestions are and what she and I have come up with on how to fix both the Violence Against Women Act provisions of the immigration law and how to resolve the issue of the I-864 affidavit of support during the two-year period of conditional permanent residence. We started going down that road this week. We'll finish up next week. So please don't miss next week's episode to catch the rest of it. In the meantime, please send me your comments to csiinvestigations@neteecin, that's netecin.net, or log on to Facebook and go to Until Green Card Do Us Part and leave me a messenger message. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm your host, John Sampson. See you next week.